Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of the Lambcast. This is episode 710, and we have a treat for you Gen Xers and Millennials. This week, we're going to go back to the 1980s. You know, the ones you know, the period of time when all those old movies you loved as a kid were made. Some of us lived through the 1980s, but most of you probably experienced them on HBO or from Blockbuster. And now you're passing on those films to your kids. Which films are we talking about? The fantasy films, of course. Everyone who is disappointed in the reboot of Willow, or in its cancellation, certainly had 1980s fantasy films in their blood. It was an era rich with sword and sorcery, dragons and unicorns, pulp heroes and fairy tales. This week we have a challenge for our Lambcasters. Put together a slate of films that you think could defeat Ming the Merciless or make Judge Doom melt. It's a draft, so you're competing with your fellow adventurers, and you have to outsmart them to get the bride that you want. Let's meet our assembly of heroes before we begin the battle. Usually he's faster than a speeding bullet. This week he simply hopes to get through the labyrinth undamaged. What daring! What outrageousness! What insolence! What arrogance! I salute you, Bubba Wheat, from Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights, as well as It's Time to Rewind.
As you wish.
Have you ever heard of Plato, Aristotle, Socrates? Morons! Todd Liebenau has them all beat when it comes to knowledge of obscure films. Todd, what's the password?
You remind me of the Babe.
I was expecting something completely different, but that's all right. That show's dead. Another world, another time. In the Age of Wonder, 1,000 years ago, this land was green and good until the crystal cracked. But don't worry, she doesn't get hurt or bleed. Her hair doesn't muss. It's one of the advantages of being imaginary. Jeanette Ward, what is best in life?
Ooh, there can be only one.
Everybody's got different ideas about the films that they're going to be talking about, I can tell. It's all going to be a lot of fun here. There were literally 100 fantasy films that I had listed, and I wasn't even thinking that hard, you know. I just scanned a couple of lists and said, yep, and I'm sure I've missed some. But
I think it's going to be interesting to see what everyone considers fantasy, because you can cross over some things here, so it'll be interesting. Well,
we may have an occasional discussion of that. Now, I originally had a picker for selecting the order in which people go. I was going to do the screen sharing, but I don't want to complicate my technology anymore. I'm just going to run this for a second. And first pick will go to Bubba Wheat. The second pick will go to me. So I'll be in the number two position. The third position will be Jeanette. Mm-hmm. And that puts Todd in fourth position. And you guys know how the snake draft works. We rip back and forth here. So, all right. So the way it works, of course, is that we start with the first person. We go to the end. Todd, at the end, gets the last draft in the first round, but he gets the first draft in the second round. So he has back-to-back choices. And then the same thing will happen with Bubba Wheat on the other end and so on. So it's pretty straightforward. You guys will keep track as we go along. It's round number one. Bubba Wheat, what's your first choice for the Lambcast fantasy film of the 80s draft?
Well, I don't think it's too hard a choice, because I went through, you said that you found like over 100. I narrowed my, you know, my big list down to 29 films. Yeah. And it's my first pick. I don't think we'll surprise anybody. I definitely have to go with The Princess Bride.
Mm. Yeah, I thought that would be the first pick, but understandable. Well, tell us why The Princess Bride is your first pick.
I mean, I've loved this movie ever since I first saw it. It is just so intensely quotable. Like, every moment of this film is so memorable and funny and enjoyable from the whole bookends with Kevin Arnold and all the...
I love that you called him Kevin Arnold.
I knew who you meant, but I didn't even think about that.
Yes.
Yeah, it's Kevin Arnold in Columbo. Carrie Elwes and just everybody, Andre the Giant. There's no other person, I think. I think this is one that would be very difficult to remake well, just because there's really nobody that could replace Andre the Giant in the role of Fezzik. I think that's right. It's just so incredible, and hearing all the background stories as well. And I know during the pandemic, I haven't watched it all, and I think I remember hearing about it happening and then I missed it, but the homemade, celebrity-filled remake is, I saw a clip of it pop up again recently, and that looks just incredible fun.
It's so charming.
It captured the hearts and memories of so many people, and there's no way I could not pick it.
It's virtually flawless. I mean, honestly, it's not just, does it purely embody the fantasy thing that was such the rage of the 80s and well executed, but it does it in kind of a tongue-in-cheek way, and everyone is there and commits to it, which makes it both silly and fun and genuine, like genuine heart-rending moments. And Cary Elwes, I think, often, because everyone else in it is so good, I think that he often gets overlooked in the fact that he centers and grounds that movie from start to finish. Yes, I love it. Great choice.
Go ahead, Todd.
I remember, seeing this in the theater when it came out and being very excited about it, because, this is when Rob Reiner was on that run where he could just do no wrong. He was just doing hit after hit. And I remember the second time I saw it was when I kind of realized this movie's really going to endure, because the town that I grew up in, the suburbs of Chicago, there's a large Christian college there, and they showed this movie. We went to go see it there, and they did it like it was Rocky Horror, where there were people acting it out in front of the screen and all that. And I was like, yep, this is a movie that's going to go on,
The thing I was going to ask was, how many people had this number one on their list to draw if they got the chance?
It's close. I have a couple that were tied, in case. Yeah.
All right. Well, it was first on my list, so I was not at all surprised that it went quickly, because that would have been my choice. And like you guys have already said, this is a terrific film. I love William Goldman writing. I read the novel. My wife used the.
Oh, yeah, the book is great. Yeah.
She read the book to her classes, and it was one of those things that they all really enjoyed. We did the Cary Elwes presentation of the film several years ago, and it's coming to Austin, and so we're going to be doing it again in January. Looking forward to it. So, lots to love about this particular film.
Book too. Like, that's a great point. The book is also. I use the phrase "what with one thing and another 10 years passed," like all the time, forgetting where it came from, and then it's from that book. Random.
That's okay. Time marches on. And, this is, I think, like you said, it's become so much part of the vernacular that people don't even remember sometimes that they, well, look, it's too complicated. Let me sum up. All right. Well, then it's my pick here in the first round. And since The Princess Bride is no longer on the agenda for me, I'm going to go with a different film. I know that people are very impressed with the CGI technology that we have nowadays that can produce amazing creatures on screen. But before there was CGI, there was model making, there were puppets, there was animation, there was just incredible creativity. And I found a dragon that I believed really existed, and I'm going to pick Dragon Slayer from 1981.
Good pick.
Well, it is an often overlooked film. I don't know that people find it as endearing as I do, but I love Peter McNichol as this want-to-be sorcerer, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's really kind of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice story, only done in a bigger world. And Ralph Richardson as the sorcerer who's too weak and old to get there by himself, and you know, basically feigns his death as a way to transport himself to help destroy the dragon. The whole mythos about sacrificing a virgin every year to the dragon as a way to ensure the safety of the villages. And it was just very nicely put together. And like I said, for 1981 technology, I think it looks fantastic. That dragon is awesome.
I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't see it back in the day, but, you know, in my adult life seeing it. And yeah, it's really fun. It's, you know, one that I thought, man, if I had seen this as a kid, I would have just been all over this. And it always surprises me. This was actually, it was a co-production. I forget which studio released it, but Disney partnered with whoever it was, to release this film. It was one of two films right in this era where we don't think of them as Disney films, but they partnered with another studio. The other one was Popeye. And for a film that is under the Disney banner, this is pretty, you know, it's not Disney in terms of some of the things in there. So yeah,
it is kind of suggestive in a few places, and it's also very gruesome, because there is that scene where the one girl does get consumed by the little dragons. That's a little tough to watch, but I just think it works really well. I would have enjoyed seeing more adventures in this world or reading about them, but you know what, we don't need sequels to everything. Sometimes it's just best that something rests in your heart and you enjoy it that way. Jeanette,
yes,
it's your turn.
Labyrinth, not even a question. You're going to leave it open for me.
I was so hopeful.
Not even a question. It's so funny. I was trying to explain this to someone yesterday, where when you consider Jim Henson, and most people are like, yes, obviously, Kermit the Frog, Bert and Ernie, you have the Jim Henson, the Muppets, the everything that is great and good for kids. But when you let Jim Henson go, when you're like, here's some money, do what you want, and you end up with something as beautifully intricate as Labyrinth, where the puppets move seamlessly in and out of the human characters, to the point where really there's two humans in the movie. But you don't think about that because everyone is on equal ground as a character. It's fabulously done. And then when you add in David Bowie, who seemed to have gotten the same note, like, hey, go ahead, do what you want. And the songs are fantastic. The costumes are incredible. The sets are amazing. Everybody okay?
Yes.
the worm. I honestly, if you have to pick, like, and it's almost impossible for me to pick, like, what's your favorite set piece? What's your favorite character? I love the waltz, the As the World Falls Down song, the MC Escher bits at the end. But that worm who gives her the wrong directions because she didn't ask the correct question is so precious and just wonderful. The whole movie, it's great. And I feel like it holds up. Like, you can show that to kids today and it holds. Parts are a little scary, absolutely, but it holds up.
Yeah, my wife just a month or two ago for our anniversary, she gave me a T-shirt that she made that has the bookworm and the little speech bubble that says "hello."
Perfect.
Yeah, well, I was pretty sure this was going to be the one or two pick, you know, either Princess Bride or Labyrinth. So, Jeanette, I'm glad that you got a film that you love and you wanted. You're welcome.
I knew once I had the last spot, I was like, oh, this is going to be hard.
And I feel like the top five or six, like the first two or three rounds are going to be tough for all of us, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Labyrinth, I mean, it's an all-time favorite for me. I mean, as a puppeteer, this is the film that I think more than any of the other things that Jim Henson did in the cinematic realm, this is the one that me and my puppeteer buddies have most tried to copy. I would say there are things in this movie that we go, let's try something like that. And, you know, I mean, like, we're like, oh, we're pathetic. We can't pull this off. You know, that the helping hands especially is the one that everybody wants to do in the puppetry realm. And we just can't pull it off as well. But I've always said that this movie, I'm convinced that, you know, somebody went and plugged some wires into my 15-year-old brain and and made a movie based on what I would like, because this is, you know, directed by Jim Henson, full of his creations. You know, I'm like I said, I'm a puppeteer. I've been interested in puppetry my whole life. It's produced by George Lucas, the man who made me a movie fan in the first place.
Uh-huh.
It's written by Terry Jones of Monty Python, who, you know, at this time in my life, Monty Python was very much shaping my sense of humor. It was on every Sunday night on PBS, and I used to watch that thing. And I went to the theater on the first day, first show, with all those things in mind. And then all of that went out the window because this gorgeous girl stepped onto the screen and my biggest celebrity crush of all time started when I saw Jennifer Connelly for the first time. I love the puppets and all that other stuff, but a crush was born that day. But Labyrinth is one of my all-time top favorites.
Can I also, the one thing that always blows my mind, and sometimes I forget, but the fact that Gates McFadden was one of the, like, Goblin
choreographer. Yeah.
Love
that. That's an interesting, look, there's so much in that film that is just weird and strange. It doesn't surprise me at all that we find these other weird and strange connections. And Todd, it sounds like you said it exactly. It plugged into your brain and pulled out all the stuff that was really important. And then it sprinkled a little bit of stardust on it with Jennifer Connelly.
That would, just sub in David Bowie for me and we're all set. Same thing.
Well, Todd, your choices have narrowed a little bit, but not much. There's still plenty out there. So what are you going to choose for your first round?
Well, you know, it would have been great to get Labyrinth, but, you know, that would have been good. But what is best in life is to crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of their women. So I will take Conan the Barbarian. Just a wonderful,
no argument,
violent, epic. I mean, the total, complete polar opposite of Labyrinth. But I mean, the movie that put Arnold on the map, he'd done a few things before this, but this is where people were like, oh, look at this guy. I remember rewatching this a few years ago for another podcast. It just blew me away again. I mean, skillfully directed by John Milius, who just is the right guy for handling material like this. Just so many moments of this film are just awe-inspiring. James Earl Jones. I mean, you know, but I mean, Arnold just fantastic. And I mean, it surprised me. Some of the moments of this film, they give me, they're emotional. The scene where young Conan's mother dies right next to him, and the way Milius films that, and we see just a hint of the head drop out, and I'm like, oh my, that's just amazing.
There's basically little to no dialogue for the first, it's a significant amount of time, and it's so beautifully executed visually, you don't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great, great movie.
You infidel defilers, you'll drown in your own lakes of blood for selecting this one.
It's also very quotable.
Yes. For as little dialogue as there is, right.
It was on my list. It's okay. Yeah. Everybody's going to be disappointed at some point or other not getting a film that they wanted. I'll be mildly disappointed here, but it's a great choice, Todd. And the, you know, it's tough getting old because John Milius, you know, I remember that easily. Basil Poledouris. That's what I was trying to think of. The composer. Yeah. That music is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, the sequence when they when he penetrates the impenetrable fortress, and they got the music playing, and it's just really very well visualized. And I, like you said, there are moments in it that are very emotional and tender. Sandahl Bergman has that one scene where she's talking about Conan, talking to Conan about, let's just quit. You know, here's what I've imagined in the world. Here's what I've seen other people, you know, in their tents, comforting each other and living together. And I want that. I'm ready for that. And it's so sad that it doesn't end up happening that way. And it's, this is a terrific movie, and I wish that King Conan was showing up, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew I couldn't sit on this one. I had a feeling it would get snatched up by Richard before it came back to me. So, yes, but now I get to go a second.
And this you get to go a second time. So, second
this is round. Harder. This is harder. I think I've got so many I want. I think I'm going to go with Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. Plus, Todd, you become my least favorite person all of a sudden. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, this is a movie that, I mean, it did nothing at the box office, but this is one that we all just fell in love with on cable television. It showed over and over again. And it's like there's so many layers to it. Every time I watch it, I catch on something new. I go, oh, I didn't see what Carpenter was doing there, you know, or I just, you know, when you first see this as a teenager and you think, all right, this is a fun, wild adventure. And then you realize what the character of Jack Burton is really about and what they're poking fun at there. And, you know, that he's not really the hero of the story and all that stuff. And I mean, I love just that this is a movie where Carpenter just threw everything at the wall and saw, you know, it's like whatever sticks, you know. I mean, we've got kung fu, we've got sorcery, we've got floating eyeball monsters.
Floating eyeball monster.
I mean, all kinds of just crazy stuff. It's just so delightfully weird.
So delightfully weird. Kim Cattrall and James Hong. I mean, it just...
Thank you, James Hong, yes.
Someone give that man his flowers over and over again. Wait, what a fantastic, fantastically ridiculous movie, and works because of Kurt Russell.
Mm. Yeah.
Kurt Russell does the best John Wayne impression that you're ever going to find, where he's not really playing John Wayne, but he steals every behavior, every tick, every trope that John Wayne ever had, and he throws it in, and then he just does a little teeny bit of the voice to get it perfect. It's awesome. It's awesome. Yeah, this would have been, you know, this would have been one of my picks, and Todd, I don't hate you completely. I do enjoy the fact, though, that someplace in the world when this show is up, Jay will be yelling at us.
Oh, I know.
You're completely wrong.
I lost Jay's vote, but, you know, that's okay.
Well, the problem is you're getting my vote. I'm not going to be voting for my own damn list. Jeanette, what are you going to go with next?
Wait, there's so many I want to choose next. I have like six movies like I want to choose now. I'm going to go with Highlander because, and this is where you run into the... I think the instructions are to choose the best movies, but this is where you wade into the swamp of, but they're the best to me. They're my favorites. So I really love Highlander. I think I loved it more because of the TV show it spawned. Like that show was wonderful. But the movie's great. It's so, again, weird. It makes no sense. The fact that Sean Connery plays an ancient Egyptian pretending to be Spanish. At no point is he Scottish in this movie, and yet it's called Highlander, and you have this Belgian Christopher Lambert playing this Scotsman. None of that makes sense, but the movie is just clean, elegant. You don't need to understand a lot of the nuance because there isn't any. There's a group of people who live forever and they battle amongst each other to win the prize. What's the prize? It doesn't matter.
With fireworks.
Music by Queen.
Fireworks
period.
Is the prize.
Fireworks and some explosions and you get to know everything everywhere all the time. But that doesn't matter because that'll go away when we need to launch a TV show. So it's great. I love it.
Clancy Brown. Can't forget Clancy Brown.
Oh my God, yes, of course. Yeah. The movie works because of Clancy Brown. That's a dude who in this movie walks into every scene that he's in and just walks out of it stealing it 100%. Every single time he's on screen. Fantastic. And you want quotable. Like, he's so quotable that bits of his dialogue are on a lot of the songs when Queen assembled them. Amazing. Also, the, oh boy, let me see if I get the name right. Hugh Quarshie? Captain Tanaka from the... I love Captain Panaka in the Star Wars prequels because he is the guy who will tell you why everything is not going to work. he's the negative exposition guy. But in this movie shows up as, you know, Connor McLeod's one friend.
Excellent choice. I think that not only do you get to pick something that you love, but I think you've picked something that'll get a lot of votes because I think Highlander is highly valued in the community that we are operating in here. People are going to cheer you on for making such a bold choice, you know, and at the end, there can be only one and you might very well be that one.
Oh, fingers crossed.
It's been in the news here too. Cause didn't they just announce the remake?
We don't need a remake, guys.
It's been announced.
We don't need a remake.
Yeah. I saw that they're using all the Queen soundtrack again, I believe.
Also, come on.
Well, you always are happy to have more decapitations, so I think it'll probably be okay to do a remake, but I know that it will not displace the original from Jeanette's heart.
Correct.
All right. Well, then it's back to me, and my choices, like I said, are not the ones that I was originally going to be making at this point, but that's okay. It looks like I'm trapped in 1981. That was a rich year for fantastic films. This film that I'm going to pick is, the Arthur legend put on the screen in the most realistic, practical way imaginable as John Borman's Excalibur, which, you know, has so much going for it. It gives you the backstory so well. I love, old man moment again. You guys help me. Merlin. What's his name? The actor.
It's killing me. Hang on.
You're looking it up good. I'm glad.
Yeah. Because now that you are thinking about it, there's no way I'm going to remember it.
Yeah, no, it's driving
Nicole Williamson?
Nicole Williamson. Thank you. Oh, he was so great. And you get Helen Mirren in her youth and beauty. Fantastic there. And the costumes, the armor that those guys wore was fantastic. I love the idea that the Earth is really the center of all of the magic that's going on there, and that's how Morgana has to be defeated ultimately, and Merlin's connection with it. It's the lighting with the green lights and the red lights and all the fog. It's like, oh my gosh, this is cool. Lots of violence in it, of course. That's always good. And it introduced me to Carmina Burana. So there you go.
Honestly, the best thing about this Lambcast is that it's going to build a playlist of things that I haven't watched in a long time that I need to go back and rewatch.
Yeah, and I knew that this is a popular movie, but this is the first one that wasn't on my short list. I'm not a big fan of it. I thought it was all right, and I appreciate it, but one of the few 80s fantasy movies that didn't really connect with me that much.
I think I saw it 4 or 5 times in a theater. I liked it that much. I was a young married person at the time, and I think I snuck off a couple of times because I didn't have the same hours that my wife had, and I went to see it by myself on a regular basis. All right, Bubba Wheat, we're back to you. What's your second pick?
Well, I have mine, you know, organized on a nice little spreadsheet, and I was just a little bit surprised that none of my first picks have actually been stolen out from under me. I think I'm going to go with one from my go animated, and I'm going to pull one of my all-time favorite animated fantasy movie that I loved it as a kid. It is, I think, a little bit obscure for, like, it's not super mainstream, but it did have a slight resurgence. But I'm drawing this out as long as I possibly can. I'm going to go with The Last Unicorn.
Oh, I knew that's what you were going to say.
Jeez.
I had it on my list.
Yeah, it's on mine too.
Yeah, that it is just such a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. I love, and the voice cast is so fantastic. Christopher Lee, Mia Farrow, I can't remember, of Alan Arkin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the just so great. Angela Lansbury,
Jeff Bridges is in
there. Jeff Bridges. Yeah, it's so fantastic. And just the Red Bull, the Lady of Malta.
Yes.
The Red Bull is skeleton.
Yeah. Even just the brief role by Renee Oberswanis.
Mm-hmm.
From Odo from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I believe that's who plays the skeleton. Just so fantastic. It's just lovely. And I just can't say enough great things about this movie. And the author, he released a comic book. I'd say maybe it's been about 10 years ago now. And the comic book is gorgeous as well. It's just a fantastic story, fantastic movie. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great piece of animation, and you're right, severely underappreciated. I think there's certainly folks in the 80s that grew up with this thing and it has a special place in their hearts, but it kind of did not go on, I think, and so I think there's a lot of people that need to discover this film. It for my money, the best thing Rankin Bass Studios ever did.
It's very pretty, and it's my oldest daughter's favorite animated movie.
Yeah, and then I know for a little while there, for a couple years, there was talk of doing a live-action remake, and they were going to bring back a lot of the original actors. I believe this was back whenever Christopher Lee was still alive, so that kind of tells you how long ago that was. And that clearly didn't end up going anywhere. But I think if that were to have happened, especially with a lot of the original cast, I think that would have been nice to see. But at least there is still the comic book, and I don't know, maybe I think this is one that could be okay for bringing it back as a remake or something, just to help draw more attention to it, because it has kind of faded away a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then for my next pick, I'm going to go with a little bit more of the popular category.
No, don't do it.
I do like this one quite a bit. It's a lot of fun. It is going a bit more into the sci-fi fantasy, but I do think that there is still enough fantasy elements that this is not a pure sci-fi movie, and this is kind of in my bit more of the cheesy fantasy category.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm picking Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Flash.
Got another Queen soundtrack to go along with Highlander, or to go against Highlander, I should say. But yeah, this is a lot of fun. I came into this a little bit late. I would say I think I've first watched this maybe about 10 years ago, because I think I also considered this a superhero movie. So I watched it in the first year or two of my superhero movie blog. And that was really where I first discovered it. And I did kind of fall in love with it. It's just so fun, so cheesy, so silly, so campy. It's just a lot of fun to watch. I'm not going to sit here and say that it's a great movie, but it is great fun. And
it's a great movie. It's a great movie. I think it's great.
It's so fun.
It's entertaining as heck. And it's got, another, performance from Max von Sydow. So, he was in Conan. So we've got that going on. And
it's
I wouldn't
a great
surprise
cast
me at all.
In general. I mean,
yeah.
You know, Timothy Dalton's in there. Brian Blessed just steals the show.
Yeah, if there was any doubt that this was a fantasy film, just remember the Hawkman.
Yeah.
and also Timothy Dalton as Prince Baron with the sword fights. And of course, Alex J. Jones in the lead.
Well, and, we've talked about a couple of these movies saying how quotable. Flash Gordon is so quotable. I love some of the ridiculous quotes in that, like, not the boy worms!
Hawkman, war rocket.
Dispatch war rocket Ajax and bring back his body!
And the hot hail.
Yeah. Another movie where they just threw everything at the wall and just like, And also is so wonderfully respectful of the original Flash Gordon serials and comics. I mean, to try and copy that look of things in the 1980s, just amazing.
It was one of those films where they said, in 1980, they spent $20 million on it, which was a lot of money in those days. And you said, where's the money? It's all up on the screen. You can see it. It's right there.
Show me every single penny.
All right. Well, it's back to me. And you know what? Bubba Wheat has not got the only unicorn movie on the list because I'm going to choose Ridley Scott's Legends.
Of course you are.
Oh, Richard.
I will defend this movie. I think it is one of the most beautiful movies ever made. It looks fantastic. Yep. And he should, Ridley Scott should have gotten so much more credit for this because it was the fact that it was not a financial success, despite the fact that it had a young Tom Cruise in it and Mia Sara and
Tim Curry.
It's just. It's a fantastic looking film, and I think it's very well made. And Tim Curry is one of the best. Well, I don't know if you want to call him the devil, but dark figures. It's just great. And the makeup there is fantastic, and his voice is terrific in this movie. And I thought the unicorns were quite believable. And even though we get some kind of screwy secondary characters that sound, it's Billy Barty is showing up and poking around with some other folks doing things. I just think there's so much exciting, interesting, weird stuff in this movie. And you could watch this movie with the sound off and still be happy to be watching it. Yeah. But with the sound on, it's even more entertaining.
So let me ask you, director's cut or theatrical?
I was going to say, both versions are great.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen the director's cut, so I would probably stick with the theatrical.
It's not director's cut, it's European cut versus U.S. cut is the difference. Because this opened in Europe in 85, it didn't open in the U.S. till 86. And they made quite a few changes, and one of the big things being the soundtrack.
I was just going to say the Jerry Goldsmith soundtrack is, I think, superior to the
Tangerine Dream. I like them both.
Oh, Tangerine Dream. That's right. Yeah.
I think the Tangerine Dream soundtrack adds kind of another level of weirdness to the movie that I think is quite delightful. And especially in some of the scenes, I mean, we're talking about Labyrinth and how the music and the David Bowie songs, you know, play into things there. And I think there's some great musical moments in Legend too. I love the dance that Mia Sara has with the gown. The gown comes out and dances. And then, you know, they merge together in that. And it's just such a wonderful concept. And it plays so well in both versions. Both Jerry Goldsmith's version of it is great, but the Tangerine Dream version of that scene, just, I don't know, there's just this extra weirdness to it that I love.
Yeah, I was actually, the first time I watched it was whenever I got the DVD. So I watched the director's, well, and on the DVD they call it the director's cut. I watched that version first. And then I watched the Tangerine Dream, the short and theatrical cuts, second. And so I think that's partly biases me towards the longer cuts with the more standard fantasy score. And I think it feels more like a traditional fantasy movie with the more classical.
Okay, good deal. Jeanette? Yes. We're done talking about unicorns for the moment, or do you have something with a unicorn in it?
No, actually, I don't think there are any unicorns in Willow, but there might be, because I'm going with Willow. This sticks right around the Ron Howard, George Lucas sweet spot of, like, comedy, fantasy, over the top, absolutely ridiculous. Simple, straightforward story, and then you just throw a lot of visual nonsense at it, and it's maybe not as universally beloved as some of the others, but I really enjoy it, and I think Val Kilmer is the reason. His performance as Mad Mardigan steals the show. Again, there's a lot of fun things in this. The brownies are great.
I love the brownies.
the brownies are wonderful. The fairies are kind of fun. The giant. Okay, first of all, the trolls, and then the acorns, and then the giant two-headed monster, which may or may not have come out of a troll and got hit by an acorn.
Don't think
about any of that. Yeah. It's just awesome to see a giant stop-motion clay two-headed monster threatening a bunch of people in an empty castle. It's fabulous. I enjoy it. I even liked the random sequel show that we got earlier this year. Was that this year? It's fun. I enjoy it. I'm super happy I get to pick it.
Yeah, I'm disappointed because I started the show and I liked it okay. I didn't fully get pulled in, and then it just boggles my mind that they just took it off and just threw it into the ether. Like, I don't understand the reasoning, and even Warwick Davis has recently came on and says he doesn't understand the reasoning behind doing that. I can't take up that much server space. I just don't understand studios sometimes and their decisions. I know it wasn't super well received critically or popularly, but, you know, some people enjoyed it. And, like, I just don't understand what's the harm of just leaving it available.
Well, and especially if it's a streaming show, you have to give it time to find its audience. Forgive me, I don't remember if Willow was a huge critical success at the time it was released. I feel like it wasn't.
I think it wasn't. It was a commercial and a critical flop.
A lot of the movies we're talking about today really found their audience thanks to VCRs and videotapes and Blockbuster. And I think anything that you release now that's even anywhere in the same vein, you have to give it time. You have to let it sit. So I don't know. That's the whole.
Yeah, I think looking at the list, I believe the only one that was a commercial success was, like, Highlander and Conan. A failure.
Well, Todd, I'm sure that you don't have a failure in front of you. You have something fantastic that you've let percolate for a long enough time that we all know it'll be a classic. So what is it?
Well, what I've got next is a classic. But again, I don't know that this was a huge box office at the time. But the first one I'm going to go with, I mean, since I couldn't have Labyrinth, I'm going to have to take Dark Crystal.
Oh, sure.
And satisfy my puppetry with that one, my Jim Henson love. I mean, the Dark Crystal, less accessible than Labyrinth, I would say, definitely, because it's, you know, it's very dark. I mean, I remember when it came out, and, you know, there was, like, you know, there the news on the TV and stuff were saying, folks, this is not Kermit and Miss Piggy. You know, just because Jim Henson's name on it, there's some scary moments in this. But I think the Dark Crystal is just one of the most wonderful examples of world building in an 80s fantasy film, because everything had to be created. You don't go on location and shoot a world like this. This is completely in the imagination of Brian Froud and Jim Henson coming up with this world. And they just created some amazing things and testing the limits of their puppeteers. I mean, some of those costumes/puppets that the puppeteers are in, I'm sitting there going, where does the person fit?
Yeah.
It's just awe-inspiring. Some amazing puppetry work in this. I mean, this is coming right off of Frank Oz, who co-directed this one, had worked on The Empire Strikes Back and brought Yoda to life. And, I think some of the things that he had done with Yoda there in bringing a character that, I mean, people walked out of the theater after Empire and were like, was that a man in a costume? They didn't realize it was a puppet. And Henson and Oz just expanded on that with this movie. And it's still just visually captivating. So, yeah. Glad to have the Dark Crystal on my team.
Yeah, I remember the land striders and the crab things. And those are, I think, two creatures that often get forgot about because, like, the Skeksis are so intriguing. The Gelflings are amazing. Her little, the Fizzgig ball of fluff.
I remember seeing the behind the scenes and them talking about the stripping of the Chancellor was one of the most difficult and complicated scenes to pull off, just this massive Skeksis and removing the clothing of one of the characters, and it's all done through puppetry. It was what, like 30 puppeteers or something like that, all trying to cluster around in this small space and choreograph all of that. It's incredible, and it looks so effortless whenever you see it on screen.
And, I was just surprised it wasn't your second pick instead of waiting until the third round.
Well, there was some other ones there. I mean, I figured there was going to be a battle for Conan and Big Trouble. So, yeah, I thought I can wait a little on the Dark Crystal. I want to throw out here, too, real quick. I mean, the puppets are amazing, but the sets in the Dark Crystal, incredible. I mean, I always remember the shot when they first go to Agra's lair and the doors open up and you see this huge mechanical thing that is spinning and rotating and moving with arms and things. I was like, oh my gosh, that is real. That's a real thing they actually built. Incredible. Incredible.
And the music, too. The music is fantastic. Oh,
great score. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so.
And my wraparound.
My wraparound. I got to go to one of the kings of fantasy films. I'm going to take Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits. Which, again, going back to my love of Monty Python and stuff, it's wonderful to have a fantasy, somewhat kids film, that has the Monty Python kind of sensibility to it. There's so many just crazy things about it. I love how we not only go into history, but we go into, other realms of fantasy. We visit fictional historical characters, like Robin Hood and whatnot. And then just the whole, God versus the devil dynamic of things in the final act and all that, I think is a lot of fun. I remember seeing this in the theater. My mom took me to go see this in the theater and she just did not get it. She was like, that was weird. What was that? But of course, as kids, we loved it. And one of the craziest endings of any movie I can think of.
It's such a downer ending if you think about it. It's almost like like the Graduate style ending. It's like, what? Just leave it this giant question mark, which is so weird for what is ultimately supposed to be like a kid's movie, because you have a kid as the main character, but there is so much adult stuff in there and so many deep themes. And I know it's. Hopefully it does eventually come out, but there is a Movies by Minutes podcast that started this movie Time Bandits Minute, and I guested on it a couple years ago at this point, and it really just made me think about this movie on a completely different level, and just some of the themes and how you can really take a deep look at what the film represents and the how the beginning of the movie has all these objects in his room that represents the toys that the kid is playing with. And those are all the time periods that they visit throughout the movie. And it's really well done filmmaking too, on top of just being a fun fantasy movie. And on top of that, just, I know we didn't really cover it whenever we brought up Willow, but also having such a large cast of little people as the main characters of this movie is something really forward thinking and something that we haven't seen much since outside of like Willow.
Todd, you were not supposed to touch this. This is evil. And it's like you were talking about them having plugged into your brain years before, you know, and producing Labyrinth. I think you plugged into my brain and produced your list. Son of a gun.
I know how you think, Richard. We've been doing this for 10 years or so.
Little things hitting each other. That's what I like. All right, Jeanette.
Well, I'm going to go with Lady Hawk.
I thought Richard was going to take Lady Hawk.
A Richard Donner movie, which is always kind of a surprise, but just beautifully done, where you layer the romance in between Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer, and the always together, or always together but never together, always together, always apart. It really wonderful. Great storytelling. And then again, with the layer of comedy, Matthew Broderick's character semi-narrating and constantly talking to God, and as Philippe the Mouse, like, he's so charming and so fun.
Funny performance. Yeah.
Yes. But adds that layer of humor and approachability to a movie that otherwise could have been really, really a bummer or really a downer. Like, the rest of the story until the very end is kind of beautifully sad. So I like the movies that kind of find a good way to wrap everything together. And again, the cast in this is a young Alfred Molina for no reason. Fantastic sets, a great soundtrack, you know, the 80s kind of synth music as Rutger Hauer rides on his horse across a landscape. It's just wonderful. I love it.
We've actually hit the first movie that I haven't seen yet. That's I have missed this one, although I have heard of it, but I have not gotten around to this one.
It's one that gets lost, I think, because I mean, it's, you know, you look at like Matthew Broderick's career. He's coming off of War Games, which was a big hit, and then he does Lady Hawk, which was kind of didn't do that big box office, you know, and then comes Ferris Bueller. So I mean, it gets lost between War Games and Ferris Bueller. And likewise with Richard Donner, just a few months after Lady Hawk comes out, releases The Goonies. And everybody remembers The Goonies, but a lot of folks overlooked Lady Hawk.
I don't overlook Lady Hawk. I look at it every day because that poster is up in my bedroom, and it's one of those you know, I literally am sitting here going, okay, now where do I go? Where do I go? Where do I go? Because you guys keep finding all the good ones, all the ones that I was – it's okay. I'll get there. Yes, this is a terrific film, and you know, it's got Rutger Hauer in it, so it should be higher on everybody's list. As a result.
And he is magnificent in it.
He's great. It's all right. Now it's my turn. And now I have to figure out what I'm doing because yeah, that's gone. That's gone. That's gone. That's gone. That's gone. That's gone. Okay. All right. Well, this may be out of left field, but I think it'll work. I'm going to go with, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
See, I thought about it. I was borderline.
Doesn't count? I mean,
I think, you know, I got to go with what my brain was thinking, was that I was maybe going to try it at some point myself. So I can live with it.
Yeah, this was one of the movies that I saw it, you know, it shows up on the Google list, but I didn't really think of it as my type of fantasy.
Mm-hmm. When you have animated creatures operating with human creatures, I think fantasy is definitely in order. I'm willing to make mm-hmm. that argument. And like I said, and my options changed quite a bit. It wasn't going to be my top choice. It might have been my last choice, but it had to move up a little bit. And I think it may be, except for Princess Bride, it may be the best film on our list so far. It is a fantastic movie. It's one of the great achievements in cinema, the way they mix the animation together. But the thing that I think is an even bigger achievement is the fact that they got Disney and Warner Brothers to mm-hmm. let them use their characters. It's like, I don't know whose arms got twisted and who did the arm twisting. I'm sure that there were people that I know in the world who are involved in saying, come on, let's make this happen. This should be a thing. Let's do it. And I'm just glad that they did.
Well, yeah, I believe one. I believe one trivia I heard was that, like the scene with Daffy and Donald, they had to have the exact same amount of screen time, the exact same amount of lines, yes. and the fight had to end in a draw.
Well, and I think that rule that, you know, they had to have the same amount of screen time, you know, like, you know, Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny got to have the same amount of screen time, whatever. That brought for some wonderful things. That dueling piano sequence is brilliant. It's amazing.
And of course, if you're a kid who grew up watching cartoons, you're looking in all the scenes in Toontown for all of the characters that you used to know and love. And, you know, oh, yes, I remember that. There's Droopy. Oh, my gosh. In the elevator. It's just it's name dropping everywhere. And it's so much fun.
Well, and you know, I don't want to overshadow, too, the live action cast, because Bob Hoskins is incredible there, and Christopher Lloyd is amazing. Yes.
Usually the Lloyd, best use of Christopher Lloyd, aside from maybe the Dream Team. Yeah.
He was the eccentric actor to insert into movies in the 80s. It was like, who do we get? Well, let's get a Christopher Lloyd type. You know what? We can get Christopher Lloyd. Let's get him. And he was in all those fantastic movies. So I feel good about this pick. Bubba Wheat, we're back to you.
All right. Well, again, surprisingly, I kind of feel like I've lucked out here a bit, because everyone seems to be a slightly different fantasy fan than I am. And I'm also going to go a little bit off center and dip my toes a little bit in the horror sci-fi category and pick another animated movie. And this is a movie that I absolutely loved. It was one of my first, like, after Akira, this was one of my first exposures to anime. And I'm going to go with Vampire Hunter D. And it's vampires. It's a gorgeous film. It's maybe a little bit underseen, but I think anyone who is a fan of anime probably fan of early anime would know of this movie. It's had a couple re-releases with different dubs and different English dubs. But, you know, I've always been a fan of the original, and it's like this classic kind of stoic Western with D is the strong, silent type who comes into the town and has to basically rescue this maiden from being a vampire bride. And you eventually found out that D is the half-son or the son of Dracula. And it's weird. It's got a lot of sci-fi twists. It technically takes place in the future, so there's like laser rifles, but there's also a lot of sword fighting, which I think that's enough to give it that fantasy bit for me. And D generally fights with a large katana, and I love it. It's a great film. And if you haven't seen it, it's worth checking out.
Well, I haven't seen it, so I will be checking it out. I like anime well enough, but I've never, you know, immersed myself in it. And so it's one of those things that if it comes up and somebody has recommended it, I'll give it a chance. Otherwise, I kind of skip by. But you've now created a recommendation, so I'm going to put it on my list. That's a good start.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth watching. It can be a bit gory in a few moments, but overall, I think it's an entertaining movie and worth watching. And for my wraparound, I think I'm going to go back to the kids' movies and go live action. I'm stuck between two. I think I'm going to go with the one that I initially did not put at the top of my list in this category, but I think it's definitely one that a lot of people love, and it has the one extremely heart-wrenching scene that I think has killed a lot of kids. And I'm going with The Neverending Story.
You can have it.
Not so much puppetry, but it does do a great job of blending this fantasy world with a lot of human characters and a lot of non-human characters. And it really does remind me a lot of Labyrinth, just with all these different fantastical characters like the rock biters, the racing snail, and Atreyu, and you know, the giant turtle sage, and the southern oracle scene is just so nail biting and intense, and it has the whole wraparound story with Bastion. Mm-hmm. And you have the childlike empress through it all. And, you know, I think it does get a little bit of a flack for the name of the childlike empress, naming her Moonchild, which definitely it dates the movie a little bit. And I always have had had trouble understanding what he was saying. And for the longest time, I never knew what he was saying, and a lot of people
just reacted legitimately. Moonchild, that's what. See, I always assumed that we never got to know because he just yelled it into the storm.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people like that reading of it. That he yells something that we can't understand because it could be any name. And a lot of people like that reading of it rather than what he actually says, which is Moonchild.
I think you can also, I think this is a film that fits along very well with Legend, just in terms of kind of, you know, some of the ideas and the types of creatures and things like that, the storybook origins, and also just given the fact that both films are ones where you have directors who are known for certain types of movies doing something in this, you know, kind of child story fantasy realm. And this is Wolfgang Peterson
directing this for.
Yeah.
And it also has, you know, some scary moments like with the Gamark. The wolf creature.
Well, I think it's traumatizing. Jeanette obviously is.
And you know what it is? It's that swamp scene, and with the poor horse. To this day, it feels like such a perfect visualization of depression. And when you are going through it, just slogging through a swamp that is taking everything from you, including your best friend, your horse, everything. And you just, there's no choice but to continue through. But yes, I'm trying to disregard that scene. The rest of it is visually stunning and fascinating and well done, but no thank you.
And the other part, you know, these look like strong hands.
Oh, God, that too.
Oh, I'm, you know, it's, this is why these drafts are so much fun. You know, Todd and Jeanette scooped me on the last round, and then here I go. I've got never ending story right in front of me. I can get that. No, I can't. that's okay, because I do have a pick that I think is going to work here, and I do think it'll be a little bit of a, I don't say revenge makes it sound like I'm after somebody. I'm not after somebody. I just want somebody else to feel the pain that I occasionally have felt here.
No.
I'm going to go with Splash.
Oh, now that's interesting, because I deleted that from my list thinking, well, this is surely a comedy, not a fantasy movie.
When you've got mermaids.
I think it works. Yeah.
All right.
Well, Splash is, you know, it was the first Touchstone film. It was a Disney film that's a little bit more adult. It put Daryl Hannah in probably the most iconic role in her career. It's Tom Hanks becoming the movie star that he was going to be. And, you know, obviously the comedy thing was a big deal, but it was like the perfect combination of those things. It was the final groundwork before all of the big things that followed. And it is another Ron Howard film, and it's funny. It's clever. You get John Candy and Eugene Levy, and, it's just, I don't understand why anybody wouldn't want this film on their list. It, to me, is entertainment multiplied by five. It's got a lot of good stuff in it. It's funny, clever, romantic, and it's really nicely made. It's put together. And I always, whenever I hear tequila, I think of this movie.
And the film is single-handedly responsible for making Madison an actual girl's name. Because, you know, she chooses that name in this movie based on the name of the street they're on. And he says, well, that's not a name. And that quote is 100% true at the time this movie came out. And then people started naming their little girls Madison. And that's the way it is now.
Yeah, I think it's still in the top 10 girls' names for baby names.
You know, and it's interesting because it's the second fictional story to have that kind of impact on the names of people, because in Peter Pan, the name Wendy was never used before. Mm-hmm. And when Peter Pan came along, Wendy became a name that people chose. And now we've got Madison. If you name your daughters Ariel and Madison, though, you are just living a fantasy world. You're not having two mermaids. Jeanette? You're next.
Yeah, I am a little bit shocked that this hasn't been taken yet. But if we're going to talk about the look of these movies and one that I feel like is, boy, just kind of set a standard, but not really setting a standard in terms of just continued a standard of Ray Harryhausen effects. And really was the first time I had seen.
Oh, no.
The first time I had seen these used to this level, and just one that lives rent free in my brain in terms of, like, not just an incredible Medusa, but the, you know, the Scorpion. Listen, Clash of the Titans, 1981.
Oh, Jeanette.
Harry Hamlin is a young Perseus. Just, I love this movie. Oh, the owl. Google the owl, who makes no sense in this movie. Probably should be in the movie. And yet, it's just really fits. I love it. I think it's fantastic. And, oh boy, Laurence Olivier has just kind of set the standard as to what I think the Greek gods and goddesses were doing and look like, and how they moved humanity around on the essential, like, chessboard of existence. I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah.
It's a great looking movie. All of the characters that you mentioned are great. There are fantastic scenes. I just don't think it's assembled as well as it should be. It doesn't move very much like a movie. It's got all of the right parts, but it's missing the blood that makes it flow, in my opinion.
It is several really cool set pieces.
Yes.
Loosely strung together. Yeah, that's fair.
Well, yeah, it's all about Harryhausen. It's all about the Harryhausen.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the effects are the focus of this.
And those Harryhausen scenes are amazing to this day. I mean, as we were getting ready for this podcast, I was like, all right, I want to refresh myself on a few of these films. I was pulling up scenes from Clash of the Titans on YouTube, and I was just like, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I'm 11 years old again, watching this at my grandma's house on HBO. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just.
When the Kraken first appears and slowly comes up over there, it's fantastic.
And somehow you've picked the other big 80s fantasy movie that I have not seen.
Wow. I will say, when they tried to remake this using, oh boy, Sam Worthington, the only part of it that I will never forget, Toby Kebbell is in it and playing, I don't know, the son of somebody. And they refer, at one point, a character comes up to him and says, I've heard you're a great disappointment. And he goes, that's right. I am great. So there you go.
Todd, you're next.
Okay. Well, this one was hinted at a few minutes ago, so I'll just go ahead and take it. I'll take The Little Mermaid, the last great movie of the 80s. I mean, 89. And I mean, this movie is amazing. It kicked off the Disney Renaissance. And I mean, we had some pretty low points in the 80s when it came to Disney animation. I mean, just 12 months before this came out, we were sitting down to Oliver and Company and kind of like, okay, Billy Joel songs are cool, but you know, but The Little Mermaid just changed the face of animation. And I mean, it's just a wonderful fantasy fairy tale story. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I got enjoyment out of the one that came out this year, but you know, you can't hold a candle to this. This is wonderful.
Well, I think you're right about launching the Renaissance. You know, nobody's going to dispute that. This is the film that got it going, and the songs are fantastic. The performances, the vocal performances are really good, and it has a fantastic look to it. All of those characters. You know, Ursula is just, what the hell?
Oh, amazing animation and an amazing voice performance. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just, again, I don't want to slag on the remake here, but I mean, just the difference between what Pat Carroll does and what Melissa McCarthy does is astronomical.
Oh, you poor, unfortunate soul.
Yeah, I love this, but I didn't have it on my list again because it's not quite my type of fantasy that I thought of for picking it. But this is a great movie, and I also love the 90s series Saturday morning cartoon that came after it. So I think I watched that a lot more than I watched the original movie.
Well, that was one that I recorded for my kids to watch, and I think they saw it quite a bit. I never saw that. I don't remember watching it myself, but this was one of those movies that when people talk about how kids can watch a movie repeatedly over and over and over again when they're mm-hmm. little, this is the one that was going on in our house. Mm-hmm. All right, Todd, you have one more chance to tick me off.
Oh, okay. This is the last one. So this is tough because, you know, all the ones that were in the upper part of my page are gone now. And a lot of times with the last pick, I tend to go with something that I kind of say is for me more than anything. And I just don't know which one I want to do for that. I think this one, this is purely personal because people have mixed feelings about this movie. I think there's certainly a lot of things to enjoy about it. I'm going to take Return to Oz.
Ooh, boy. Bold choice. I
think the reason, part of my thing with this, okay, the 1939 The Wizard of Oz is my second favorite movie of all time, behind The Empire Strikes Back. That's its own thing, though. I have never considered this a sequel. I've always considered this to be just another look into the world of Oz, which is something that's always intrigued me. One of the things that is very special for me as a memory when my daughter was very young is that we, as Bedtime Stories, read through the original 13 L. Frank Baum Oz books.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You know, just a chapter a night type of a thing. And this film goes into those realms that, unless, you know, if all you've ever seen is the 1939 musical, you don't know all that other stuff. And there's so much wonderfully weird stuff in those other Oz books that they touch on bits and pieces of in this film. You know, I get to see characters in this film that I really enjoyed from those other books, like the TikTok, like the Gump, like Jack Pumpkinhead. They've changed some things around with names and things like that, but the witch that, that has a closet full of different heads and she changes her head depending on her mood. You know, that's out of one of the books. You know, I loved that concept when I read it in the books. I thought, oh, this is just so wonderfully weird. And bringing the Gnome King in there, who is kind of the villain of the Oz books that is more throughout the series. Mm. You know, the Wicked Witch of the West is in that first book, but it's really the Gnome King that we see more throughout the rest of the series. So seeing him in here is great. And, you know, there's some wonderful stop motion effects that bring him to life. You know, I realize all the complaints that some people have about this movie. There are some things about this movie that I know are terrifying for some people. You always hear people, you know, beware the Wheelers. People always talk about how freaked out they were about the Wheelers and that Dorothy gets taken off for electric shock therapy and things like that. You know, I admit there's some things about this that I'm going, guys, what were you thinking when you put that in this movie? But I still think there's a lot of really charming and interesting things about this movie, especially for folks that are a bit more interested in the fuller scope of the world of Oz from the books. So that's why I'm picking it here.
Is that a chicken?
Yes.
Yeah, this was, I had a tough time between deciding on this or Neverending Story for my live action kids pick. This was right up there for me as well. I love this movie just as much. It's so imaginative, and it's that right mix of scary and wonder that a lot of these 80s kids movies have, these 80s fantasy kids movies have. And I think that it gets the mix right. And I feel like it's good to scare kids a little bit once in a while.
I feel like the Return to Oz has this bizarre effect of, like, I saw it once somewhere and then never again. And I've talked to other people who have this same relationship with this movie where there are these vague images and very random memories of, like, specific things, moving walls and marching and these odd, again, the visual set pieces of the movie where, and then no one can remember exactly where it was from or what the rest of the story was, but just the very vivid imagery of it. I have never gone back and rewatched it. Maybe I should. Or maybe I shouldn't. But
well, it is a little disturbing. It's dark. And like you said, electroshock therapy on a child seems a little scary. And I just, you know, I've got a bad pun that I want to make here. So, Jeanette, after Todd has balked on his choice.
That's great.
What's your next choice?
Boy, I've got 3 or 4. This is the final round here, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. Boy, I am tempted to go Masters of the Universe. just for the...
I take a bold choice. I mean...
Well, here's one that's going to be even more bold, and I'm going to go with Red Sonja. This is one that I saw and loved when I was young. I haven't seen in a long time. Does it hold up? Probably not. Did it hold up at the time? Not really. but I always have kind of a soft spot for it. It was fun to see in this sword and sandal epics that were kind of rolling around at the time. Female characters were, you know, questionable most of the time, often not great. It was really fun to have a lead in one that was on equal par with some of the more notable male heroes. So I think I'm going to go with Red Sonja.
I can't fault you too much on this because I have a little bit of a soft spot for it as well. I did have it on my list of possibilities. It's not great, but I will watch it. I will watch it any day before Conan the Destroyer. Brigitte Nielsen, we all know, not the greatest actress. Okay.
Right.
I think a good choice to play Red Sonja. And Arnold holds it together. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. having Arnold there is worth something. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also have it on my short list right next to Masters of the Universe.
See?
Well, the movie isn't necessarily great, but I'll tell you what is great about it. The poster is great.
It's a great poster. And now I'm struggling on the names. Who's the score on this? The maestro. Morricone did the score. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't remember the movie that well. I just do remember the look, and I remember the poster really well because my wife had it up on the office wall when she worked for the L.A. Department of Water and Power, and they made her take it down because they thought it might be violating their sexual harassment policies.
I mean...
Well, if there's going to be sexual harassment on this show, is probably going to come from my next choice, and we're going to go the opposite direction. Some of you have looked for kid-friendly films and been a little bit worried about that. This is not kid-friendly at all. This is all adult-based. This is one of those original films that I discovered in college. Well, I obviously was out of college, but I was in grad school at the time and went with students to see this because it was playing late at night and it was interesting. And I'm going to go with Heavy Metal.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. I had it shortlisted. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good pick.
This is an anthology film that's just full of rock music and inappropriate animation and sexual references and violence like you can't believe. And like I said, it's not really made for kids, but it was made for kids my age at the time, and I was the age that it was made for. So I had vivid memories of it, seeing it when I was a kid, and then years later it was one of those films that didn't really there were rights issues with the music.
Yeah, you couldn't see it for a long time.
Yeah. You couldn't find it for a long, long time. And then there was a Laserdisc, and it was a short print, and I couldn't get a hold of it. That pissed me off. But it's now available and definitely worth seeking out for those of you 18 and older.
There you go.
There's some great animation in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of different animation styles. I think that's always interesting to see when you have an anthology like this and you've got, you know, each story kind of has its own unique animation style to it. But I mean, it's funny because the stories are extremely juvenile. You're basically, you know, catering to the blood and boobs crowd, you know, with these, and you know, that's fine, I guess.
That's HBO's tagline, isn't it?
Yeah, HBO blood and boobs. No,
it's the blood and boobs hour, you know, 10 p.m.
That's right.
And it's fun because a lot of SCTV folks are doing the voices. You know, John Candy's in there, Harold Ramis is in there, so yeah.
Yeah, it's hit and miss for me, but it was another one on my short list, and there are some great segments worth watching.
All right, Bubba, you get to finish off our draft. So what's the final pick here?
Oh, this is tough. I'm actually a little bit surprised that I have a lot still on my short list to choose from. I don't know if I want to go cheesy or go a little bit more serious or pull something and maybe have just different from everything else. But I think I'm going to go with a personal favorite of mine. And this is from a director that he did one other movie that has been chosen in this draft. And I always liked this one better than the other one because it feels a little bit more adult, more grown up. And because it is more or less about old age in a certain way. And I'm going to go with Terry Gilliam's The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Yay.
Very good.
The only reason I didn't take it is because I already had a Gilliam film.
I love this one. I like this one better than Time Bandits. It's always been a favorite. I've always really enjoyed the legend, like the story of Baron Munchausen, and I'm a little disappointed that it hasn't been tapped as often as a lot of other characters. There are surprisingly few Munchausen adaptations out there. I feel like it's ripe for movie making. It's very fantastical and visual, and the whole tall tale aspect of it I really enjoy, and the whole metatextual narrative with this. You know, as you're watching this movie, you're not sure how much of his stories are fictional and how much they're true. And, you know, similar to Time Bandits, that you do have this kid that's introduced, and that, you know, she's not as much a presence in the stories. It's more about him telling her about his adventures, but she does get brought in towards the end. And mixed in with some of the present details, and just the look of the death character that is this dark, black winged skull angel of death in a way is fantastic. And it has a lot of, Monty Python alums in it as well. You know, Eric Idle as, I forget his character name, but the
Bertolt,
the guy. Yeah, that can run really fast. And again, just all the fantasy sequences, and John Neville as the main character. He's fantastic as Munchausen himself. And really just, I think, a great way to put a capper on my list. And I think it fits really well with all of the other ones that I have.
I think I may be the only person who saw this in a theater that year. I really like the film. I love the Terry Gilliam films, and it was one of those ones that I look forward to. I had to drive down, you know, 20 miles away to go to see it. I got there and I sat in the theater by myself, and I went, where is everybody? Why isn't anybody else here? I don't understand. This is a movie that I think people just forget exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, well, you mentioned a few cast members, but a lot of great people in this movie. Oliver Reed is in there, and Robin Williams is in there. Uma Thurman's mm-hmm. in there. He's great. Mm-hmm. One of her first roles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, folks. We've got our list. We've got 30 choices here for you. Hopefully you'll find some that you love. Most of the ones that you love are going to be in my category, so make sure to be paying close attention to that.
These are all good lists. These are all yes. good lists. Mine is the best, but these are all good lists.
Well, and I got to admit, I don't want to belabor things here, Richard, but there were a few movies I put down that I was like, if I were to pick these, I wonder if they would be, you know, if they would be accepted as fantasy.
It's 24, not 30, because there's only four of us.
Oh, yeah, we dropped some. But like, I shortlisted like Big, for example. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is that fantasy? I had considered The Purple Rose of Cairo.
I had that on my list. That was almost the last choice for me.
I'd consider Cocoon.
I was very disappointed. I was very disappointed that I couldn't fit in a Studio Ghibli movie because, I think all of them, Nazca, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Castle in the Sky, those are all 80 movies. I love each and every one of them, and I really wanted to fit them in, but it really pained me to leave them out.
Well, I noticed that nobody jumped in for the Ewok Adventure or the Battle of Endor.
They're on my list, but I felt like I was editing myself. Yes, they were TV movies, and also I feel like they're going to get lumped in with Star Wars, which I'm going to, honestly, yes, probably a little fantasy, but I'm lumping that into science fiction adventures.
Yeah, yeah.
They're on my list.
One other honorable mention that I was disappointed by, I feel like I am one of the few people that genuinely love this movie, is Krull.
Krull's fun.
I was just going to say, as we crawl past the finish line. We need to move on. We're going to take a quick break to hear from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our question of the week.
Why This Film Podcast looks back at the movies of your childhood. Join me, Emily Slade, each week as I step back in time to revisit the films that you grew up with. Maybe you haven't seen it for a while. Maybe you've watched it every day since you were 8. Maybe you totally forgot it existed. Whatever the movie, I'm here to go back with you through nostalgia untold and memories unnumbered. Together, we'll ask, why this film?
We're back, and it's time for our exit question of the week. We've been talking about fantasy films, and, you know, fantasy films are one of the things that has made movie going interesting over the years. We talked about it a couple of weeks ago on our horror spooktacular that, you know, the idea of the horror genre didn't really exist. Although there were horror films, it really became codified with the original Dracula. We've had a ton of fantasy films over the years that have probably led to all of the Star Wars movies and led to even the superhero movies that we enjoy nowadays. So the question comes up in my mind, and I thought about this when I was trying to find something for us to talk about here. Regardless of the date, who or what, in your opinion, is the most significant fantasy character in movies? You know, who do you think has had the biggest impact on the world, biggest impact on cinema? What fantasy character matters in the universe? And I know I didn't have to think long and hard for my answer, but I'm going to wait to give that to you until we hear from Jeanette, Bubba Wheat, and Todd. Jeanette, ladies first.
Tempted to pick, you know, Jareth the Goblin King from Labyrinth, but I feel like the obvious answer is Conan the Barbarian, Arnold Schwarzenegger's version of Conan the Barbarian. I think it established what you could do with an Austrian bodybuilder who had the correct mindset for breaking into the U.S. Movie market. He's been very clear about, like, I set out not to be a great actor. I set out to be a movie star. Knew what he was doing, chose the right roles. This fit him like a glove. You have intriguing source material, the right people around it. I think it established what are widely held to be accepted truths about the fantasy genre, about the way it should look, the way it should be handled, what it should be. I think that Conan is a character that if you mention to people, like, what do you think about 80s sword and sandal fantasy movies, Conan's going to be on the top of everybody's list. So that is why I'm saying Conan the Barbarian.
That's a very reasonable answer. And of course, you know, if we didn't have Conan, we wouldn't have had our previous governor of California. So, Bubba Wheat, how about you?
Well, I think I'm going to go with Gollum from Lord of the Rings. I especially for modern cinema, if we didn't have Gollum, we wouldn't have the almost over-reliance of the motion capture technology that we have now. I think it's really... He was a really big proof of concept character to show that CGI, whenever you actually put the focus on the CGI technology and the motion capture technology, that you can get a real three-dimensional character from a fully CGI character. And I think that in itself really changed the course of, to a certain extent, of cinema from that point on. I know he wasn't the first, because you can also go back to, I think Dragonheart was one of the first CGI characters that used at least some, I believe they used some facial capture. I don't remember if they used like actual facial capture or if they just recorded him and used Sean Connery as a visual reference for the animation. But Gollum was really getting a full performance from a character, and a CGI character that wasn't just, you know, a foam ball on a stick to a certain extent. Sure. and was a far cry better than Jar Jar Binks, which would have been the other option, which
the much maligned Jar Jar.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Todd, do you have somebody who's much maligned?
I hope not. I as I was thinking about this, I was trying to think in terms of, well, what do a lot of these fantasy stories have in common. And I came kind of to the idea of there's a central character who the audience has to kind of live through, kind of experience this unique world that they've been thrown into. And I think that you see that in a lot of our picks. You know, you see that in a film like Labyrinth, like Legend, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, certainly, Time Bandits. You know, a lot of these movies, you have a character who is experiencing this fantastical world, so we're seeing this all through their eyes. And as I kept kind of working my way back through movies that had this theme, I, of course, landed on Dorothy Gale out of The Wizard of Oz. I think, this is, kind of the experience that we see Dorothy go through and the way she experiences this new world that she ends up in is a theme that we see in a lot of other fantasy films that have come since then. I remember seeing an interview once with Jim Henson, kind of behind the scenes stuff on Labyrinth, and they were talking about when they were figuring out the story and saying, oh, well, we want to do it with a young girl. We haven't really seen that before. And we started working on it, and they said, oh, but, then we realized it's Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, but that's fine. I think a lot of what we see with fantasy films can be traced back to The Wizard of Oz.
I think that's a good explanation. Yeah.
Well, I think all of your choices are good ones. Like I said, I had an answer that came immediately to mind, and I thought for a second that Todd was about to step on it, but it turns out he didn't. I'm going to go with King Kong, because to me, King Kong is the original fantasy character brought to life on screen that made everything that followed possible. People get a chance to see, look what we can do, look how our imaginations can follow from our brains, and we can put it on screen. And everything that has followed in the last 100 years is a result of people being influenced by that moment. We have Harryhausen films on our list, and Harryhausen, of course, exists because of the original King Kong, Willis O'Brien's King Kong. And when Todd was talking about how we're experiencing the story through one of these fantasy characters and identifying with them, and that's exactly what you do with King Kong. King Kong is not the monster. He is the character that we identify with. He's heroic in some situations. He does do monstrous things, but he's kind of a victim, and he's taken to another part of the world and exploited and resists and fights back, and it's all for love. And human beings are affected by those kinds of things. And, as a consequence, I think that, movies and our imagination have been strongly influenced by that character for the last 100 years.
That's a great pick.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Well, folks, we have been having all kinds of fun with fantasy here. It's my fantasy that Todd didn't go in front of me, and I got to pick several of the pictures that he picked. But that's not the way it works. I know it's not fair, but I can say that as often as I want, but I don't know what the basis for comparison is. Through dangers untold and hardships unnumbered, I fought my way here to the podcast. I hope to take victory with me, but I believe it may have been stolen. My will is as strong as yours, and my kingdom maybe not as great. But to everybody, to the pain. Mm-hmm. And we'll catch you next time. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell! Go to hell, oh no, go to hell.
hell.
Ha 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 ha